Good evening. Welcome to One Step Beyond with me, Theo Chalmers. If you have any questions for my guests, text them to 86686 with the word beyond, a space and then your message, and we'll pick up on all the good ones. They're charged at standard rate. We're going to continue the show tonight for a second hour for subscribers to Edge Extra at edgemediatv.com. So if you want to watch it all, and I strongly suggest you will, there's still time to subscribe. If you love the topic of deep political conspiracies taking place over generations and across vast land masses, then tonight's show is for you. Tonight I'll be interviewing investigative radio journalist and noted researcher Tony Gosling and retired electronics engineer and European Union historian Dave Barnby. We will be discussing Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands and the super secret, super powerful organisation, the Bilderbergers, that he is credited with founding. The location of this year's secret meeting in June, attended by heads of state, bankers, and political puppets waiting to be anointed, has now been worked out by conscientious researchers, and it looks like it will take place at the Chantilly Westfields Marriott Hotel in Washington, D.C. We'll look at the alleged collaboration between the Allies and the Nazis in World War II and subsequently, possibly involving Hitler's deputy Martin Bormann, who allegedly survived the war with the money seized by the Nazis, estimated by British intelligence to have totaled more than $180 billion by the end of 1943. We'll look at Hitler's plans to create a post-war superstate, strangely very similar in many ways to the European Union we have now, and other aspects of the hidden history of the EU. Anyone who feels that Europe is unaccountable, undemocratic, and out of control is strongly advised to watch. We'll also be looking at what you can do to mitigate the worst effects of it on your life. So, let's take One Step Beyond with my guests, Tony Gosling and Dave Barnby. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Theo.
Hello, Theo.
Nice to see you both. Tony, you've been on the show before, quite a long time ago, actually, on my previous show, On the Edge. Dave, we've never met before.
No.
So, do you want to give me a quick fill-in about what you do and who you are? So, Dave, we start with you, shall we?
Well, I'm a retired telecommunications engineer. I spent most of my life working around the world installing satellite earth station, microwave links, notably in Nigeria during the Biafran War. Mm-hmm. And things like that. I retired some 15, 20 years ago and started getting interested in how the world is run. Mm-hmm. You have the time to start looking at those things, and I picked up on quite a number of facts which will come out during the next hour or two.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay, and Tony?
Well, I started my journalism career really in community radio in London, then worked at the BBC doing mm-hmm. research for their drive time show every night right across London. On with the Johnny Walker programme at lunchtime and also Tommy Vance in the evenings. I was working in the 1990s. So that's where I sort of got into journalism. And the great thing about that station was, because we were based in London, we were doing a lot of national and international stories. So it was almost unique in local radio, as it was a local radio station, that we were doing so many heavyweight stories. And it was just great fun. And mm-hmm. it's one of those things that when you're in a busy newsroom, people shouting around stories and you're looking at a bulletin coming along, you never lose that wish to find the best story and to get there before anyone else.
Did you smell a rat about the control of the news media?
I mean, certainly we weren't controlled, I didn't feel at the time, but things are getting worse. Of course, the number of journalists are being cut back all the time, right across journalism. There's less actual paid jobs, and as the number of journalists in a newsroom goes down, so there's less work that they can do. The other thing, of course, is that individual journalists are able to get out much less. They're sitting at their desks, they're having to do work from press releases more and
more. Well, it's called churnalism, isn't
it? Yes, that's right. Yeah, Nick Davis did a very interesting book all about that. And now we're getting to the stage now where, yes, it is very controlled. I mean, just look around Europe, Theo. Goldman Sachs are appointing prime ministers across Europe right now. These
well,
are not
Greece.
People who are... Yes, and in Italy. And what's going on is looking more and more fascist, actually, all the time. That is to say, the democracy is being slowly eroded by the people with the money.
Okay, and you also have a Friday night radio show in Bristol, don't you?
Yes, I do a drive time show in Bristol on the community radio there, which is quite well listened to and also gets out other parts of the world on the internet. And what we try and do is we have a politician on, then we do a bit of investigative journalism, because I think that's what's lacking so much today in what we see on our TV screens is the sort of stuff you're doing here to a certain extent, which is actually probing yeah. in and finding out what's really going on rather than just accepting what people are saying at face value.
All right, well, let's go back a little bit into the mists of time, or at least into the Second World War, and let's look at Arnhem, which I believe was one of the biggest air attacks of the Second World War. Well, parachute.
That's right. It was the biggest airborne operation of all time. The idea was, Montgomery's plan it was, to do a real kind of hard punch into the Nazi Empire in France and in Holland. You know, there'd been a bit of a stalemate after D-Day. The idea was to make a big punch through the lines. And the whole thing went very badly wrong.
This is the operation that became the film A Bridge Too Far, isn't
it? That's right, Robert E. Levine's very famous film, which is a terrific film, but it's got some things wrong and some things right in the film. And, you know, Robert E. Levine himself would probably admit that, you know, these films are made for money, not necessarily absolutely adhering to historical fact. But it was actually Dave that got me sort of interested in Arnhem because of its links to what I've been looking in for years, which are the Bilderberg conferences.
OK, well, tell us a bit more about that, Dave, then. Tell us what really happened at Arnhem, the unofficial version, if you like.
Well, it's quite a long story for a short programme, but basically it was designed by Montgomery with the approval of Eisenhower, his boss, mm-hmm. to, as Tony has said, to charge into the Ruhr via Arnhem. And this required a massive force, but it was dreamt up at very short notice. I think it was around about the 6th of September that the whole operation was dreamt up, and the time for planning was very short. But there were a lot of egos to satisfy, and the planning was very, very badly done, and it was very badly implemented. There were two lieutenant generals, for a start, who obviously not going to take orders from one another. So the three drops took place at Eindhoven.
In Holland.
All of it was in Holland. The 101st American Airborne Division dropped on Eindhoven. The 82nd American Airborne Division dropped on Nijmegen. And the British 1st Airborne Division dropped on to Arnhem itself. And the idea was that the 30 Corps, which would be about 60,000 men and tanks, were to shoot up the highway, the single track, was a double track highway from the Belgium-Dutch border to link up with these three airborne divisions. The problem was an airborne division can only last theoretically about 48 hours. So the armour that's coming up to link up with them has to get a big move on, and that was part of the problem. They're very slow.
But was there another agenda?
You're getting on to some of the characters in the episode. For instance, I think you're alluding to Prince Bernhard, his involvement in Market Garden.
I should just say that Prince Bernhard is the man credited with starting the Bilderbergers.
So. Yes. He was the first chairman of the Bilderberg, and it was only recently Dave brought it to my attention that Bernhard actually was involved in the planning process. Now, Bernhard was an SS officer. Up until 1937,
he was an enthusiastic early Nazi uniform.
Yeah, yes. And what happened was, he was involved in Whitehall in the planning. Now, this is quite controversial because quite clearly, quite a lot of the Brits would be rather nervous about having a former Nazi in on the planning of a big operation like this. Mm. And it was quite clear that the Admiralty, the Royal Navy at the time, actually prohibited Bernhard from working anywhere near them. But King George VI. Gave specific orders to Ian Fleming and other people in MI6 saying you must
allow... Ian Fleming, the man who wrote the James Bond books.
That's right.
Books.
You must allow Bernhard in on the planning because we can totally trust him. So he was endorsed by the king, and so therefore the army had to have him in. So this is Montgomery and Horrocks, who was commanding the land forces, had to have... And there are pictures of the three of them together looking at the plans.
Yeah, there is a picture showing Prince Bernhard at Market Garden. And that's one of those you can...
It was called Operation Market Garden, wasn't it?
But the witness...
Which one is that?
This one is... actually, it's
It's not on there.
It's not one of the pictures that we've got.
No, it's not.
We do have pictures of the three of them together. Yeah. The most important point being that some of the problems with Market Garden may possibly have been because Bernhard was still working for the Nazis and was feeding information back through other lines, back to the German lines, because there is a myth about Arnhem, and that is that the Germans, and you'll see this in the film, The Bridge Too Far, that the Germans had actually managed to get hold of the plans. That has been shown to be very unlikely to just be a myth, because no one's actually been able to pin down. There's been various different stories about
how the plans
were found.
Well, maybe they did get hold of the plans.
Maybe they did.
But
maybe
not
they got
in
them,
the way that you
maybe
might
they got them from
otherwise
Bernhard.
Think. Well, possibly. But wasn't there also, weren't there also British people acting as though they didn't want to
I don't agree with that. I think there's no evidence any of the generals or the high-ups running the show were treacherous in this.
That incident with the tank then that you told me
about? No, that comes later.
One thing's very clear about all this, right? There was a guy called Sir Brian Urquhart, who was an intelligence officer involved in the planning of Market Garden, that was literally banging his fist on the table saying, this is never going to work. This is going to be a carpet of dead airborne soldiers that you're trying to get these tanks across. And he was quite clearly booted out at the early stages. He was not the popular person, but he was later proved entirely right.
Yes, but what you've got to remember there is the airborne division's been stationed in England for quite a few months, and they're twisting their fingers, very anxious to go. They were all highly trained, and they really want to jump and fight. And the overwhelming force behind us was to go, regardless of any German troops. We'd been so successful in breaking out of Normandy, getting up to Belgium and lined up along the Dutch border. They felt that nothing could stop us, and they also thought that the Germans were totally defeated and beaten, and their tanks needing repair. So I think I can understand the drive to actually make this happen, regardless of it. So I don't believe there's any treachery involved there. There was just stupidity.
Well, what about this incident you told me about?
Well, this is the fascinating thing, is we've got Bernhard involved in this, who was later to become chairman of the Bilderbergs 10 years after all of this. We've also got Lord Peter Carrington as a captain in the Coldstream Grenadier Guards, sitting on the bridge at Nijmegen. That's the second of the three bridges. Mm. Now, they had literally a couple of hours. They'd managed to take that bridge, literally a couple of hours, to get to Arnhem to relieve the 1st Airborne Division. And yet, he is sitting in his tank and going nowhere, and he's decided to make a cup of tea. This is by the testimony of a guy from the 82nd Airborne Division.
The American.
This is a historical record, who he had made an incredible river crossing on the basis, an assault across the river to take the other side of the bridge, lost half his men, half his company, and several other companies too, in order to take this bridge, with the promise that the tanks were then going to roar off to Arnhem. And what was Carrington doing in his tank? He was sitting there drinking tea.
Well, how do you explain this then?
Difficult.
Well, let's go back to Bernhard just a minute, because not only was he in the war planning back in England, he did actually join the forces in the 30 Corps driving up through to Eindhoven. We've got pictures showing him doing this. But you've also got to remember, back in England before Arnhem, he was in charge of the Dutch SOE, Special Operations Executive.
And which is like the Secret Service?
Well, no,
SAS.
No,
the
no, no, no. They were tasked with setting Europe alight, sabotage and things like that. And it was quite successful in France and places like that, as you've probably heard, blowing up railway lines, making it difficult for the Germans to transport their tanks across about the country. But in Holland, it was a total disaster. There were about 50 agents, Dutch agents, dropped into Holland, and they're all picked off one by one, either shot or turned to send false information back to Britain. But who was in charge of the Dutch section? It was Prince Bernhard. Now, so we've got a pattern of suspicious circumstances.
We've got a pattern of failure, haven't we?
And on top of that, we've got another chap who was General Gubbins, who was in charge of SOE Europe-wide.
General Gubbins?
Yeah, Major General Gubbins. Now, when we come to the Bilderberg meetings, as we will shortly, What do we find in the first Bilderberg meeting? We find General Gubbins, and we find Prince Bernhard. Now, the other thing to know about the first Bilderberg meeting, it was held within the bounds of where the drop zones were. And this was exactly 10 years. Some people.
It was held at Arnhem, wasn't it?
Well, it was in Oosterbeek, which is just outside Arnhem, but the whole area was the Battle of Arnhem.
In the Bilderberg Hotel.
And it was held in the Bilderberg Hotel. It almost looked like it, some people say, liken it to like a celebration of Britain's defeat 10 years previously.
Dave, we're going to go for a break now. If you'd like to text in your questions or comments to Tony Gosling and Dave Barmby, please do so now to 86686 with the word beyond. And we'll see you back here again very soon.
One Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine. One Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine.
Welcome back to One Step Beyond with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guests, Tony Gosling and Dave Barnby. Okay, just before the break then, we were talking about the first Bilderberg conference, which took place effectively in Arnhem.
That's right. The thing is, it's in exactly the same spot as what was called the Hexenkessel, which is the Witch's Cauldron, where all these German tanks and flamethrowers were surrounding the British forces as they were slowly being crushed in Arnhem. Exactly the same spot. 10 years after that, 1954... was the first Bilderberg conference with Bernhard chairing it, who was the guy who'd been involved in the planning of Market Garden.
Okay, and you mentioned that this this general who was there...
General Gubbins. General Gubbins. He was in charge of SOE. So you have to ask yourself, why would a British general want to go to a meeting which had the feeling of celebrating a British defeat 10 years before? Why would he want to go to that meeting?
In a place where that defeat took place.
He might not necessarily know the significance. This is one of the things we found out, and I have to plug Robert Kershaw's book, because anyone that's interested in Arnhem, if they've not read this, they don't know what happened.
Right, this book is called It Never Snows in September, if we can see that. I haven't read this book, so I don't know what it's like, but it's an account of Arnhem.
I'll explain why it's so important, and that's because Robert speaks fluent German, and he's been and talked to loads of the veterans, the Germans who were there. But I suppose, you know, this whole thing about history is written by the winners, right? That's the way they thought it was going to work.
Winston Churchill said, "History will be kind to me. I know that because I'm going to write it."
That's exactly right. And they thought that no one was going to find out the German version of events. And what the Germans have told us, particularly the commander of the 10th SS Panzer Division, who was in charge of that area at the time...
And the Panzers are the tanks, right?
..was that they were very worried at the moment that Lord Carrington was at the bridge and crossed the bridge, that they weren't going to charge up the road. Because he actually says, Heinz Salmon actually says, and Robert Kershaw interviewed him before he died, if they had carried on up the road, it would have been all over for us. And so that was the point at which Lord Carrington was sitting by the side of his tank having a cup of tea. And the American guy, Moffat T. Burrows, came up to him, who just lost half his company, and pointed his Tommy gun at Carrington's head and said, "Get down the bleeping road." And in fact, that incident is in the film, The Bridge Too Far, with Robert Redford getting angry, you know, with the British guy in there. So you'll see that. But he expands massively on that in the book and explains...
I think it's an important point here. We're still on Arnhem, but there was a three-hour window of opportunity that night. The bridge was crossed at 7 o'clock. In Arnhem, the major who was... John Frost, Colonel John Frost, had been wounded that morning, so he was out of the picture. But Major Hibbert, who was the brigade major, took over from Frost. And at 7 o'clock, they arranged a truce with the Germans. The Germans were playing ball, to a large extent. They were very humane at that battle. And they had a three-hour truce to exchange, get the wounded out and put them, get them to hospital. But, of course, during that time, the Germans were actually infiltrating the perimeter which they were holding. But there was that three-hour window which, if the tanks had gone the 9 miles between Nijmegen Bridge and Arnhem Bridge, there was this window of opportunity to pour in 20 or 30 tanks but everything came to a halt that evening.
So the chance was lost.
It was a chance.
All right, I think we need to move on. I think we need to move on to the Bilderberg conference. So you mentioned this chap to me, Joseph Rettinger. If we can see picture 103, and Dave, if you can tell me who this Joseph Rettinger.
Yes, that's Joseph Rettinger. Joseph Rettinger was a Pole, as you can probably gather from the name, and he was the aide to Sikorsky during the Second World War.
The helicopter man?
No. He was General Sikorsky.
General Sikorsky.
He was in charge of the Polish forces.
He was a Polish leader in exile. And he was also a Freemason, by the way, which has been found out since.
Right?
As well, yes.
So he...
And Stephen Dorrell, in his book, The History of MI6, says he was working for MI6, as we know, right way through the war. Yeah. Obviously he was, because he was looking after a foreign general.
But he was Sikorsky's aide, and he used to travel with him everywhere. But Sikorsky met his end in Gibraltar, where his plane took off and crashed. And at that particular time, Rettinger wasn't with him, the first time he'd not been with him. And there's this book here, written by Pierre Daniel Villemarest, and he claimed...
What's that book called?
The Facts and Chronicles Denied to the Public, The Secrets of the Bilderberg. Okay. So he claims that Rettinger was responsible for Sikorsky's death. So whether that's true or not, you'll have to read the book and decide for yourself.
Of course, it was massively embarrassing that you had this Polish leader who, and there was a deal about to be cooked up at Yalta, where Poland was going to be given away to the Russians.
Poland was sold out, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
So it's interesting, isn't it? Because the reason that Britain entered the war with Germany was because of our pact of mutual defence with Poland.
Which was
End of the Second World War, at the Yalta Conference, which was Stalin,
we gave it away.
Roosevelt and Churchill, they gave it away.
Well, I mean, that was to the
Russians.
Yeah. I mean, that pact with Poland was totally unenforceable. It was the most stupid thing that Britain's ever done, in my opinion.
Okay,
But Rettinger founded the Bilderberg meetings. He started this in 1952. There were some steering group meetings long before Prince Bernhard came on the scene. Bernhard was the figurehead of the Bilderberg. But Rettinger has a double role here, because he was not only started the Bilderberg organization, he also started the European movement together with Duncan Sands, who was Churchill's son-in-law.
And an MP.
Yeah, and don't forget, Churchill had this bright idea after the war that we'll have. He actually thought up the idea of the European movement, but he didn't follow up, and it almost died a death until Rettinger took it over. Now, the interesting thing is, I found out about Rettinger, and I only found this out a few days ago, and I should have known about this 10 years ago, because Andrew, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, was ferreting around in America and found these archives, which showed that Rettinger was an agent working for the Americans.
You just said he was working for MI6.
Yeah, MI6. Yeah. So he's working for Stephen Dorrell's. I think, you know, there is this sort of nexus, isn't there, around the CIA or the OSS, as it was during the war, and MI6. There was definitely some dodgy stuff going on there. We're not really quite sure what was going on, but one thing we can be certain of is that the Bilderberg meetings were cooked up by something called the Council on Foreign Relations. This was in 1943, before even Arnhem or anything like that.
So Rettinger
somebody
was actually...
somewhere had decided that there needed to be planning for the post-war world, and that planning was going to be done basically behind the scenes in a very quiet, secretive meeting, these Bilderberger conferences. The War and Peace Studies Group of the American Council on Foreign Relations was cooking this stuff all up behind the scenes.
Well, the Council on Foreign Relations...
with what is now CIA money, basically.
Yeah. No, but it's bigger than that. It's a group of industrialists who got behind this. A lot of multinational companies in America made a lot of money out of the war, and they saw the war coming to an end, and they wanted to further their business. And by starting this twin-forked thing...
Well,
Bilderbergers and the European movement. The idea of the European movement was to persuade ordinary people that European integration was a good thing. So it portrays itself as a grassroots organisation, when it was nothing of the sort. It was an invention of the of these American corporations and bankers.
Council of Foreign Relations.
They call themselves the American Committee for United Europe. So that's the start of the European.
Okay, well, let's talk about Bilderbergers then. Mm. These meetings take place every year?
Mm-hmm. All apart from 1975, when, to go back to Bernhard, he was caught red-handed taking a bribe from Lockheed.
Oh,
do you
yes.
remember the Lockheed scandal of $1 million to try and get the... Well, he did succeed in getting the Dutch Air Force to buy these Lockheed Starfighters, which fell out of the sky.
Yeah, they kept crashing, didn't they?
It was a chambermaid, got a bit of paper from a rubbish bin in his hotel, and this became a massive scandal in Holland. So they had 1 year's break. Bernhard was discredited. So, this does show you a little bit about the way the guy liked to operate.
Well, apart from the fact that these are secret organisations and secret meetings, pretty well secret. I mean, certainly they don't publish any accounts. So even though they do invite journalists, they don't publish any accounts of what is discussed.
Well, just two journalists, basically, from the Economist magazine. They also invite the heads of News Corporation.
Well, heads of
they have BBC trustees. So we're talking about the big guys in the media.
Well, I know the head of the biggest daily in Finland goes, for instance. I happen to know that.
But they don't report to the public. Occasionally you see little slips.
What people, I mean, people like Peter Mandelson go. I mean, you know, well.
And Oswald, George Osborne's been.
Yes. Tell me what sort of people go. I know you've got a list, haven't you, of the kind of people who go to these meetings.
Well, I'll give you one example. I mean, the object of the Bilderberg and the European movement was to get Europe united, and the cover story for that was the Russians are dangerous, so we have to unite Europe to fight them. But that was a bit of a fallacy because although there were fears that the Russians were going to move into Europe and so forth, it was overplayed. And the Americans were rather fooled by this Reinhard Geller, who was a German spy master, and as soon as the Americans...
Reinhard Gehlen, yeah?
Is that? No, Reinhard Gehlen, yeah. You heard of him, haven't you? And he was a top intelligence officer for the Germans, and as soon as the war was over, the Americans whipped away a lot of the people they wanted, like rocket scientists, but they also...
That was Operation Paperclip,
yeah, that's right, and they moved this Reinhard Gehlen to America. But they then put him in place back in Germany, as their spy master, and of course he was the one that blew up this Russian threat. There was a threat, but he blew it up, and then that caused the arms race. And
what about the people who go to the Bilderberg meetings, though?
There's that whole list of people. I mean,
well, mainly royalty is all I would say. I think these are the most interesting people that go.
This is why it makes it so newsworthy.
Here. You've got the royalty. You've got all of the people that control most of the money in the Western world, including now, as of last year. The Chinese, right, which is amazing. I mean, it's so...
The Chinese are going to the Bilderberg.
Yeah, they went last year for the first time. We had two
high-up
delegates.
Was it in Switzerland?
Samaritz.
Yeah.
And this is what makes it fascinating, what's going on in China. With all of this coup that's just happened with Bo Xilai, for example.
Oh, yeah.
He is the old-style, more social democratic type of Chinese guy. China is now being run by people who are much more pro-Western, and they're being coaxed into the Bilderberg conferences as well. So we may see some more this year.
Let's backtrack to the early 50s I've got a list of types of people. I've studied this. I've got all the records.
Okay.
From the 52 to 64. The type of people we've got there, at the top of the list is Prince Bernhard, who is royalty, and Rettinger, who was his right-hand man, organising everything.
Uh-huh.
There were 33 bankers. This is taking over over a 10-year period of 33 bankers. These would be global bankers, the big bankers, at it. 50 industrialists, 16 military people, 49 politicians, 11 trade unionists, 22 ambassadors, 20 people in higher education, 20 media people, 22 ministers, 18 what are called Europeanists. These are ones promoting European integration. The Carnegie Trust, 2 Rockefeller people, and the Ford Foundation and Chatham House. So there's no room there for ordinary people. So this is an elite club.
Well, I'm interested the trade unionists are there because, they're prepared to take part in these secret meetings that seem to be acting against the interests of the workers.
Well, of course, a lot of trade unions sort of double timing, aren't they?
Two well, they timing. Certainly possibly well, were.
I can't possibly comment on that. Obviously, it's your opinion.
I think that's a bit unfair. I'm a trade unionist myself. Nowadays, it's very, very different. There aren't trade unions.
Yeah, let's put it a different way. These were trade unionists. They wanted. Don't forget, a lot of people went to Bilderberg, went there with an open mind, and they were being sussed out. Like when Clinton went to the Bilderberg, he was being sussed out to see if he was adequate material. They're one of their kind to be the future president of the United States.
And I think it's fair to say that the character of Bilderberg's changed over the years. To begin with, it was much more sort of friendly and nice, and let's have everyone. But slowly but surely,
but it's always been a secret, hasn't it?
But slowly but surely, the character has got more and more sinister. Mm. As they're saying to us, Theo, trust us. Yeah, you don't have to come to these meetings. We're sorting things out behind the scenes. Clearly, the financial situation is going to hell in a handbasket, right? So we can't trust them anymore.
Can we have one of those pictures?
Of course. Which one? 102. Yeah. If we go to 102, this is a picture of. Is this the first ever Bilderberg meeting?
First general Bilderberg meeting.
This is Oosterbeek at the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland.
You could see in the audience.
Actually,
looks
the
in the far corner on the right. That's the British delegation. You can see three people there together. I think it's three. It's quite a long way off. But the first person is General Gubbins. Who I was mentioning, who was in charge of SOE, and right in the corner, chap with the moustache, is Hugh Gateschall. Right, you recognise him.
Yes.
So Hugh Gateschall was one of the steering gate group people, and Rettinger latched onto Gateschall because he thought he was an important person. He was the leader of the Labour opposition back in the 1950s.
And he died, of course.
Oh, no, you're jumping the
gun. Just a minute. He died in mysterious circumstances, Gateschall. It's worth saying.
You're going far too fast. He went to a lot of these meetings. I've got the correspondence from Rettinger to him.
We're going to go for a break now. Yep. But once again, if you'd like to text in your questions or comments for Tony Gosling and Dave Barmy, please do so now. We'll see you back here again very soon.
Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine. One Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine.
Welcome back to One Step Beyond with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guests, Tony Gosling and Dave Barmby. Okay, just before the break then, we were talking about the Labour leader at the time, Hugh Gateschall who never became Prime Minister.
Well, Hugh Gateschall was obviously heading to be the next Prime Minister. This is why he was important to the Bilderbergers. That's why he was important to Rettinger, and Rettinger was cultivating him. But you can see from the correspondence that Gateschall starts making excuses to Rettinger and stops turning up at the Bilderberg meetings and the management meetings and steering group meetings. He stops turning up. And then in 1962, there's the Labour Party conference, and he comes out very strongly against Britain joining the European Union. He's seen what it
was. Well,
at
that time, it was the common market, wasn't it?
Yeah, of course. But everybody knows that the common market was going to become the common.
Well, they never said that. In fact, they denied it. Well, they specifically denied it.
Yeah, they're pulling the wool over everybody's eyes. Heath spilled the beans on that, didn't he?
Yes.
Before he died. But he made this very strong speech, which is on the record, that Britain would not join the common market, as they called. 4 months later, he was dead. Now, we don't want to go into conspiracy theories, but he died from some mysterious illness called lupus, which nobody knew very much about.
Well, lupus is a form of skin. It's a skin disease. Yeah. I think it's related to cancer. I mean, the singer Seal has lupus, doesn't he?
Well, it was fatal in those times. And MI5 was suspicious of his death, and they went to Boscombe Down during warfare unit to have the sample, haven't checked out. Yeah, sorry, Porton Down, not Boscombe Down.
Which is where they did all the bacteriological testing of those kind of...
So we've got another couple of nasty strange little things, a bit similar to this. First of all, Margaret Thatcher, she announces, I refuse to hand over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers. Within 2 weeks, Michael Heseltine is standing against her and she is bumped out of being Prime Minister. We also
I've just got to bathe in that moment for a second there where Margaret Thatcher is the good guy.
Well,
and it doesn't
no, but yes, but I think what happens is people are useful for a certain amount of time. As soon as they start to think that they are really in charge and make decisions which the elite, these power elite, you would describe them as, the Bilderbergers, these kinds of people don't like, they're out. Like John Smith, for example, who was leader of the Labour Party, he was invited along to a Bilderberg meeting in the early 1990s, rather like Hugh Gaitskell, and he quite clearly was not on the Bilderberg programme for globalisation and monetary union and all this kind of stuff. He was a very intelligent guy and he spoke against them. He's the sort of guy who would actually do really good speeches in the House of Commons, the opposition. You know, and he mysteriously died.
He was definitely...
mysteriously died.
He was a very...
To be replaced by who?
Tony Blair.
Who was very enthusiastic at the Bilderberg meetings, telling everyone how wonderful it all was.
And you can also add to that Ian Duncan Smith, who was in line to become the next Conservative Prime Minister, but as soon as he started talking anti-EU, he was out.
Well, Ian Duncan Smith is still alive, isn't he?
Yeah, indeed. And he's not the Prime Minister, is he?
No, he's not the Prime Minister.
But Herman Abbs is the other person.
All right, we've got a picture of Herman Abbs. This is 105, if we can go to 105. This man is Herman Joseph Abbs, a German banker.
Yes.
And part of IG Farben,
the
biggest industrial corporation in Nazi Germany.
Well, Herman Abbs, before the Second World War, worked for IG Farben, and as you say, he was chairman of Deutsche Bank. In fact, he was effectively Hitler's banker. Very important position. When the war ended, he was rounded up with a lot of so-called Nazis. I don't know whether he was a Nazi. He didn't wear it on his sleeve, as far as I know. But he was rounded up and he finished up at Nuremberg. He would have gone to trial and he was in jail for 3 months. But he managed to get his friends in America and Britain, his banker friends, who got him off. And he then went straight back to being the director of Deutsche Bank and IG Farben. So he
IG Farben was broken up after the Second World War, wasn't it? Yeah, into companies Bosch, like Bayer,
that's right.
Bosch.
That's right.
And
a few others, yeah.
Yeah.
But he was at the first Bilderberg meeting. So you've got to ask yourself, why are these sort of characters being invited to Bilderberg meetings when a war is being fought to stop all this sort of thing? And of course, the great suspicion is that these people were brought in to turn Germany into a part of the European Union and so forth. And
well, they were also buying into the whole NATO thing, weren't they? Mm. At the time, NATO had just been formed and the Soviet Union was the great enemy. NATO and the Bilderberg are virtually the same thing. And this is why I mentioned the Chinese being brought in as a very surprising thing. It only happens in the NATO countries. The last meeting that took place in Britain was organised by the Duke of Kent's personal assistant. This is Andrew Palmer. So there's another connection with Freemasonry, as the Duke of Kent is the Grand Master of World Freemasonry. Mm. His personal assistant organised the last Bilderberg meeting in Britain. So I think, you know, we've got some definite Masonic connections there, not speculative. There's definite connections. And the Bilderberg conferences over the years, as I say, have got a little bit nastier, particularly with what's going on now with the financial situation and starting to appoint prime ministers. So if they say this is just a private meeting, keep out. What is George Osborne doing at the St. Moritz Bilderberg meeting last year with his Treasury civil servant team with him? And we, as the public, are not allowed to know what they're talking about, what they're discussing, what they're agreeing. Why haven't we seen the minutes of that? This is actually totally undermining
of
democracy.
So do you think it's treasonous?
Of course it is. In the US, there are actually acts, law which would make it completely illegal to go to these meetings. When people have tried to pursue cases, they've found that they've come up against a brick wall. But of course it's illegal for a public official to go to
with
a private meeting to make an agreements with these people.
Right. And
particularly when they won't allow the press anywhere near the place. When the press turned up, when I was last at a Bilderberg meeting in Belgium, as soon as all the TV cameras arrived, when they realised what was going on, all these kind of sheets started appearing at the windows of the hotel.
Can I ask how you got invited to a Bilderberg meeting?
Well, we knew where it was taking place. We were filming it. We were filming it from outside.
Yeah.
And we'd invited the Belgian TV crews, and loads of them turned up. As soon as the TV people started setting up, all of these shutters started appearing in the window, so they couldn't actually film in to find out who was
in there. Yeah, there's one more thing to say about ABS. As I said, the European movement got financed by all these American businesses in the late 40s. And they set up European movements in every country in Europe, which is obviously a big, major task. And you couldn't have done that without huge sums of money. ABS was the chap who set up the European movement in Germany. So you can understand which direction he was going to push the European movement in Germany. And that was there to persuade the people that this was a good thing.
Was this the money that Martin Bormann?
No. This came from American business. Well, Martin Bormann's money got dissipated to South America and Switzerland and so forth. It was not just money. Well, there was gold, there was patents, there were
general assets. Well, he had in 1943 was worth $180 billion, then by today's standard it must be worth...
Yeah.
Well, you can imagine what it was like for the Germans in 1943, biting their nails, saying we've looted massive amounts of gold from all over Europe, artworks, pictures. What are we going to do? Because the Allies are doing D-Day. They're coming towards us in 1944. They had to have some programme, and they were very much looking ahead to make sure that all those securities, the gold, the artworks could be smuggled out of Germany, probably through Switzerland, and got out. And then laundered, get all that money laundered, to be able to use again in the future. And that was Bormann's mission. Now, Bormann, can we have the picture of him? Can we do that?
We've got a picture of Martin Bormann. Can we have
he's,
that? There
he's one of the most important people who was an aide to Hitler right the way through the war. Very friendly with Hermann Hesse when Hesse was captured
over Scotland.
Here in
Britain. He came voluntarily, didn't
That's
he, to
right.
Scotland to speak peace.
Well, this is Martin Bormann took over Hess's role as Hitler's right-hand man at that point.
He was his deputy, wasn't
That's right. And he was missing. When the Russians took over Berlin, they couldn't find Bormann anywhere. Where is he? We had stories in the early 1970s saying, oh, we found Bormann's body at last. Actually, rubbish, nonsense. He was over in South America, and we can absolutely prove this by Paul Manning's book, which is... Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile. And he was charged with the mission of carrying on the Reich to create a fourth Reich after the Third Reich.
Because the Nazis were building these super giant submarines, weren't they?
Only one.
Well, we are not sure. Possibly two.
And one of them was found scuppered off the... Or attacked and sunk off the coast of Massachusetts
in August 1944.
But this is the one
which
that's
is
supposed
the
to
time,
take Bormann
is,
to South America.
Well, it wasn't necessarily taking him, but nobody knows what's on that submarine, but it was a giant submarine, 6,000 tonnes, as opposed to probably 1,000 tonnes of the normal U-boat.
It was basically Hitler's escape boat, built especially for Hitler. In case anything happened, he could then get in the submarine and disappear off. But it was used by the people who tried to assassinate Hitler in August 1944. And the same day, that ship, because there were a lot of people from the German Navy who were involved in that assassination attempt, and that ship disappeared from the harbour the same day. This is in Kiel.
Kiel,
in the north of Germany.
Yeah.
And then made its way across the North Atlantic. And eventually was sunk, accidentally it looks like, sunk off Cape Cod. Because it was jamming all the radio signals, and so the White House couldn't tell anybody, don't sink this ship, because it was communicating with the White House.
So the State Department had made arrangements to land in off Cape Cod.
And credit has to go to Ed Michaud from Concord, Massachusetts, And his little firm, Trident Research and Recovery, that has the salvage rights on this U-boat, which is lying off Cape Cod to this day. The US Navy have been trying to dive on the wreck, and poor old Ed has had to phone up his Coast Guard colleagues and get even the Coast Guard helicopters to hover over the top of the US Navy divers to tell them, no, this is not your wreck, you've got to leave.
Yeah, but what is also interesting is Prince Bernard's wife, Queen Princess Juliana at the time, later Queen Juliana, She had gone to stay in Canada for the duration of the war, whilst her husband was back in Europe, of course. But she made a trip to Cape Cod just at that time.
Oh, yes, she happened to be holidaying there at the same time.
And that was a specially arranged trip by the US government. We've got the documentation showing that trip to Cape Cod, and it seems you don't really have to work hard to put two and two together to suppose that she was meeting that submarine.
But she wasn't meeting Prince Bernard because he's still alive. He obviously survived. If he was on that submarine, he'd be dead.
Well, yeah,
he wasn't involved in the submarine thing. No. I don't think he was actually there at all.
No.
So what was on the submarine then?
Well, we don't know.
Probably securities, gold, all sorts of stuff.
Patents.
Part of Bormann's little operation to get all this looted stuff out of Nazi Germany. Yeah. Still, apparently nobody's actually got into the submarine even after 10 years.
But one question you haven't answered is why did the State Department give free passage to this submarine? I think you need to address that.
Well, that's a good question.
All right, I'll ask that question then. Why did the State Department give free passage to a Nazi submarine?
I think we've got...
Whilst we're in war. At that time, of course, America was in the war against
America
Germany.
Joined the war. But don't forget, America got pulled by its hair to get into the war. There were two sort of factions within the US government, pro-German and pro-and anti-German.
Well, most American citizens didn't want to go into the war until Pearl Harbor.
That's right, yeah.
But, well, they were
but
in Britain,
it was Germany which declared war on America, so it had no choice but to join the fight at
that
time.
Well, hold on a second. Germany was an ally of the Japanese. The Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. The Americans pretended they didn't know they were going to be attacked and encouraged them to attack. Then they were at war with Japan.
And then Germany declared...
But if you're at war with my ally, then you're at war with me, aren't you?
Well, it wasn't that. It was that, but it was worse. It was more than that, because Germany actually declared war straight after Pearl Harbor on America. So
they had no choice.
But the pro-German faction in the Americans were always trying to broker a peace with the Americans. The Dulles brothers were in Switzerland trying to negotiate with them. So there was all this underhand stuff going on, and that's why the submarine comes into it, and that's probably why it got free passage.
Well, after the war, Prescott Bush, who was George H.W. Bush's father, was prosecuted for financing the Nazis.
Well, this
wasn't
is
he was a banker who was...
Yeah, Prescott Bush quite clearly was involved in financing Hitler. I mean, this was this is the Bush family. Mm. Actually, they were doing, in a way, reverse of what Bormann was doing. That is, they were getting stuff in and through, including smuggling important information like formulas so that the Nazis could manufacture rubber. Things like that where they were smuggling through. This is the kind of stuff that we talk about on our show on Friday. So we do a little bit of exploration on this on the airwaves in Bristol.
One Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine. Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine.
One Step Beyond with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guests Tony Gosling and Dave Barmby. Okay, we were talking about this submarine, this X-1B submarine, this giant submarine that in 1944... somehow sank off the coast of Massachusetts.
Well, we know exactly how it was sunk. It was sunk by a US Navy blimp that was on patrol, and what that was, they had basically airships.
And they weren't told not to bomb or...
Because the submarine was so high-tech, it was actually jamming all the radio signals, as we briefly touched on before.
Yeah.
It was in touch with the map room in the White House with an encrypted signal, and Ed managed to track down the guy who was actually passing the messages on from Cape Cod up to the White House. The only trouble was, because they were jamming the radio signals, as the blimp came along, it says, I've just spotted a submarine, should I attack or not? But he couldn't get through on the radio, the captain of the blimp. And so because he couldn't get through, he took his own decision, right, I'm going to sink this thing. And he landed a depth charge actually right on the decking on the top of the submarine. Now, the submarine realised it was being attacked because depth charge was going off around it, and it did, made the fatal decision to dive. As it actually started diving, it reached a certain depth, and it had a depth charge lodged on the planking on the top of the submarine. As it reached the depth, the certain depth, the depth charge exploded.
And the guy in the blimp saw this, did he, presumably?
Yeah, yes, from above, yeah. And he gave the captain, who Ed met, actually gave a full description of it all. Now he got
he survived, the captain?
The captain of the blimp.
Ah, I beg your pardon.
Nobody survived in the U-boat thing.
Okay,
nobody.
No, okay.
In fact, there was some lettuce came up because they'd hit the
lettuce.
A bit of lettuce green. Came up into the sea
clothing
because they'd hit
clothing
the submarine
stuff, yeah.
Just above the galley of the submarine. So some lettuce came out.
Savage.
But anyway, when the when the blimp captain got back to base, they told him, this never happened, did it? And he said, yes, I'm going to file a report. And so he insisted on filing a report to say he'd sunk the submarine. And the next day he was transferred to Brazil, well out of the way. So something funny was going on, yeah? He wasn't supposed to have sunk that submarine. And, you know,
America was at war with Germany, and it was a German sub.
That's right, because there was something at a very high level going on. It may even have been an attempt to negotiate an armistice at that stage, a year before the war actually ended.
Oh, was there, do you think, perhaps some kind of bribe on the submarine, something that the Americans wanted?
No, I think this was a semi-official visit by this X-1B submarine to America. I think they'd negotiated, probably Dulles back in Switzerland, negotiated for this submarine to come across. But what it was going to do with the securities in America, I do not know. But I think it was an attempt to end the war in 1944 before you'd actually beaten the Germans.
This ship, remember, had left. Mm. The submarine had just left the same day as an assassination attempt on Hitler. So these people had definitely had enough of the war. They wanted to do some sort of negotiation. At least that's the way it certainly looks from here. You know, I think something needs to be done to look into and to help Ed and various other people to get down there with cameras, etc., and find out exactly what was in. This is a war grave, and it's got some very, very important information that we all need to know.
But if the Americans have been diving on it, the American Navy have been diving on it, then how do we know they haven't got everything out of that?
We don't know. They have been down there. Because
the Coast Guard has submarines they could use, and you'd never know they were down there.
Well, we don't know about that. The Coast Guard has been keeping an eye on it and made sure that apparently the thing has been kept.
Why would the Coast Guard not, you know, take second place to the American
Navy? Well, they're
actually
independent of the Navy. They're not the same thing.
No, I appreciate
that. Same government.
But they may be keeping to the law and the Constitution, where the Navy may be veering off to another side.
We need to go back to the link with Market Garden here, because
Market Garden was the operation of Armand.
Market Garden presented a serious threat to this this Red House meeting and getting the securities out of the country.
You can't just throw in stuff like that. No. Red House meeting was something that took place in Strasbourg in August 1944.
Just mentioned that, haven't we?
Yeah, it's basically the same time as the assassination attempt on Hitler, pretty much. There was a meeting going on where this is an intelligence report from the American intelligence services, which is, there's a very interesting article in the Daily Mail all about this, where on the 10th of August 1944, various German industrialists met in order to arrange and start plans in train to ensure that there was a continuity Nazi movement, basically getting all of these securities, all of the wealth that the Nazis had gathered from all over Europe, and making sure that that was then taken on into the future. That was then Martin Bormann's job.
They could see the writing on the wall that they were going to lose
the war.
Yeah.
That was Martin Bormann's job, and he went over to South America. He created something like 800 separate individual corporations, which he then invested
this money into.
This is all in Paul Manning's book.
Yes, all there.
The book is called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Now, Paul Manning is not just any old fella. He was the CBS News European correspondent.
Yeah, he worked under Ed Morrow, didn't he? The famous American broadcaster.
He was one of the men in Europe,
reporting back to Ed Morrow.
Absolutely right. And he was, you know, very well known to American audiences during World War II. He decided this was one of the most important things that he discovered at the end of the war. And he wanted to make sure it was all down on the record that Bormann had actually managed to make it over to South America and was very, very busy bureaucratically setting up all these businesses, which could then be invested with all the laundered money, the Nazi loot, and that his placemen could be put in charge of those corporations as directors. So this was then going to be another kind of Fourth Reich. But obviously, without people walking around with swastikas on, these are just businessmen.
This Manning chap, did he have no evidence that Hitler also survived?
No, I don't think he goes into that.
He doesn't go into that at all. He focuses on Bormann, Hitler's.
But if Hitler did survive, and there are plenty of people who believe that Hitler did survive the Second World War and also went to South America.
He's never really appeared anywhere in history since the Second World War.
Bormann, I think, is much better documented source material that Bormann definitely did survive than Hitler. That is more of a disputed fact. And certainly, I don't think the two of them, you know, if Hitler did survive, we're working together. No. This was a Bormann operation, and he definitely did survive. But
this is where Market Garden presented a problem to this operation, this Red House meeting and Bormann's operation in South America. He estimated he needed 9 months to 6 months, wasn't it, to actually bring this about, to get these assets out. And the trouble with Market Garden was it was going to end the war by Christmas. Which would have stopped them finishing their project. And that's why you can see a strong motive for sabotaging Market Garden. We've been into the potential sabotages that we've seen in the earlier part of the programme. And the question is, was it betrayed? If it was betrayed, who betrayed it? Was Prince Bernhard involved in it? Were other people involved in it? This is the big question mark which needs further research.
Well, certainly a lot of these Nazi companies in the Second World War, Nazified companies, that is to say, when you went in through the main entrance, you'd see swastikas all over the place and pictures of Hitler. A lot of these companies, of course, were involved in this Red House meeting, like Volkswagen and Krupps. Mm. All the big heavyweight companies of Nazi Germany were involved in this, making sure that there was some kind of method of getting the Nazi looted wealth from Europe going. One thing is worth saying as well is a lot of people think that BMWs are cool cars, don't they? Last year there was a documentary went out in Germany called The Silence of the Quants. It's never been shown in Britain, but it shows that the Quant family, who's a privately owned company, BMW, the Quant family actually made all of their wealth in the Second World War as a company called ABB, making batteries for German aircraft, German tanks, German submarines and this kind of thing. They transferred, and this is of course all under slave labour from concentration camps, they then transferred that wealth quietly at the end of the World War II into BMWs. BMW is basically still a Nazi company. The Nazi money has actually been taken and put into BMWs. And when, it might sound incredible.
No, I'm not laughing at you. Right? I'm just about to say that is your opinion. And obviously, the opinions of my guests are not necessarily those of
Thank
this
you.
Programme.
But
I have to say that.
A lot of these German companies, to be absolutely fair to them, have put big sums of money into funds to give payments to the families of the victims of the concentration camps.
What about
Volkswagen, for example, has put lots of money into, and a lot of people who are members of families of people who are victims of the concentration camps have got monies from these funds. BMW, certainly at this time a few months ago, hadn't put a penny into that fund, even though they've been asked many times to do
so. I thought BMW was an aircraft manufacturer because their logo is supposed to be a propeller, isn't it? Two blue corners and two white corners is apparently supposed to represent a propeller.
Let's be clear about this, because it was after the war that the Quant family, who'd made all this money from slave labour, bought BMWs after the war, not during the war.
Incidentally, Volkswagen was offered to
the British
end of the war, and we said, no, thank you very much, which was obviously another big mistake we made.
Well, you know, possibly.
I just think that this hasn't come out in Britain. It's certainly, in Germany, a lot of people are now very wary of the BMW logo and the brand. Mm. But in Britain, we still think it's cool, man. In fact, they even build Minis, don't they?
Well, they do. They've bought Mini. They've also bought, is it Bentley? They do own Bentley, don't they? Yeah. Yes. No, that's Volkswagen. They've bought Rolls-Royce.
That's BMW. Right. Yeah. So, in a way, you can see what's going on here is that wealth that was made under the Nazi era is now finding its way into some of our big modern corporations, and BMW one of them.
Well, tell us about this Red House meeting, because we haven't really gone into that. So who was at this Red House meeting?
To be quite honest, I haven't got a clue as to who was at it. It was set up by Bormann, but he didn't actually attend the meeting. It was set up, he was obviously busy working various other things, fighting the war, presumably. But he sent a lot of industrialists. I think you mentioned some of the
That's
names
right.
There.
The industry yeah. and the economic might of Germany were there, including Krupps and, yeah. and Volkswagen, etc. And it took place on the 10th of August 1944 in Strasbourg, which is, of course, it's somewhere called
Where the European Union is.
The Maison Rouge, which is the Red House in French, and I suppose probably called something else in German. But this meeting was, I think, crucial in starting the process during World War II of making sure that there was going to be a Fourth Reich and that the plans were in process. Everyone was going underground, they were taking the money out and they were going to create something new. And this is why it bothers me to see what the EU is up to right now. We've got Catherine Ashton, who's the EU's foreign minister, who nobody has ever elected, actually. She was the treasurer of CND. She's going around the world now negotiating...
The campaign for nuclear disarmament.
Yeah. She's going around the world now negotiating with the Burmese government about sanctions. She's feeling the collar of the Iranian regime, saying, oh, no, we're going to place sanctions on you. Who is she? Nobody has ever elected her. It's a bit like Chris Patton, who's the chairman of the BBC. The only only time he's ever been, the last time he was ever subjected to public approval in Bath, he was removed by the public. He was kicked out of office. You know, and yet a lot of
reward
these people are now...
He was also in charge of Hong Kong, wasn't he? The handover.
It annoys me that these people who've been rejected by the public are then picked up and put in key positions.
Well, OK, well, let's look at that question. You know, what is wrong with the EU? Is it democratic?
No, it's not at all democratic. I'm sure Dave can tell you.
And yet we vote people into the...
Well, all the European Parliament, if you talk to MEPs, they will tell you, all the European Parliament can do is temporarily block stuff if they really get their act together to realise what needs blocking. And if they block it, generally it will come along, like these Internet Piracy Acts and things like that have been happening in the US.
Oh, Pirate Bay and all.
You know, there's one comes along, it gets blocked. 2 months later, a few paragraphs have been changed. The next one comes along. And they've got to be on their toes the whole time, these MEPs. The policy is not made by the MEPs. That's all made by the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which is basically big industry.
Well, okay, well, let's look at how the EU is laid out. Who makes the decision? How many layers does it have? And who makes the decisions? And
well, you've got the European Council and the Council of Ministers. Ministers from various European countries come together every so often and they're supposed to thrash out what they want to achieve. Now, Tony Benn has explained this in detail. He went to the Council of Ministers when he was a minister. And his first request was that we open the doors to the press, make it a public meeting so we can see what's... And they all went, oh! In horror, we can't do that. And he found that everything was already decided before he actually, before anything could be discussed. And all it was a question of rubber stamping.
Well, who was it who decided it?
Well, that's probably the industries which really, I mean, the European Union is a symptom of a disease. And the disease is big business wanting to control everything.
But we need to look at... But let's look at how it actually is made and how it actually is run.
Let me give you an example, right? Philips Electronics.
Yes.
Okay.
Dutch company.
They hosted a whole bunch of people who were drawing up the single market agreement. This is back in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And they, after 2 months, a whole bunch of people straight out of university have been putting together this whole project for the single market, came along and they said, well, we don't actually think... we can do this because the sovereign governments won't agree to it. They've been, you know, basically looked after by Philips and seconded to Philips. At the end of that period, they were then told, look, that's not good enough. Imagine yourselves to be the dictators of Europe. And this is where the policy is made. So the single market program...
Is that a true incident?
Absolutely.
It's
absolutely well documented. So, you know, this is what's going on, is that policy's being cooked up by these big European and American corporations behind the scenes, because a lot of people who are on the European Roundtable of Industrialists making policy that goes to the European Union, they are the same companies who are over in the United States at places like the Council on Foreign Relations. It's not really as if there are two separate institutions here, the United States and the United States of Europe, are very much similar ideas and similar companies. The idea that Europe and America are really in competition, I think, is a kind of illusion that's been foisted on us. And I think, wouldn't most people agree that it's becoming a United States of Europe?
Capitalism, they say, is dead, except perhaps at a very low level in your local area. Capitalism has been replaced by corporatism, where you've got grand global monopolies. There's no room for competition, which is the real meaning of capitalism.
I mean, if we want democracy to survive, we've got to really fight for it, you know. And I think that the big, powerful interests, you know, this is the
so
big corporations.
Being elected an MEP is just going to a talking shop where you can't make any decisions. But so all those, you get these...
Yeah, if you're elected an MEP, you're not going to
make a decision, right, but you don't get involved in making policy. This is the whole thing. Where are these ideas coming from?
OK, well, hold on, Tony. We're going to go for a break now. If you'd like to text in your questions or comments to Tony Gosling and Dave Barmy, please do so now to 86686 with the word beyond. See you soon.
One Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine. One Step Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine.
Welcome back to One Step Beyond with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guest, Tony Gosling and Dave Barmby. OK, just before the break there, we were talking about how the European Union works and how little influence MEPs have. I mean, let's look at the way it works. So let's look at the Eurozone, because that's a lesson in something, isn't it?
Of course, over the last, 50, 60 years of the common market European Union's existence, people have been brainwashed, should we say, with the what a great thing it is, how it's going to benefit industry, how it's going to bring world peace and so forth. And that led on to the Eurozone having a common currency, which Britain didn't join, luckily. Mm-hmm. But what does that Eurozone actually mean? It means that you have a fixed exchange rate, effectively, between countries, because they're all stuck on the euro.
It means that individual countries, aren't in charge of their
economy.
They're stuck with the interest rate, for instance,
rate is set by the European Central Bank, which... Yeah. I understand is German dominated. So if you're in control of the interest rate, if you set it to your own country's benefit, you can actually make your economy drive. If you have a low interest rate,
UK does, you know.
Yeah, we have a flexible one, but...
Yeah, but it's very low at the moment, isn't it? It has been for quite a long time now.
Well, don't I know it? I mean, I've lost thousands as many people have in my bank account, but we're looking at the general picture. Germany has an interest rate which suits its industry. The borrowing costs are just right. But places like Greece and Spain, Portugal, they need a much higher interest.
But there is a head-on crash coming, you know that. As it looks like, Hollande gets selected in France...
Oh, Hollande is the socialist
candidate. Yeah. He's going to be crashing straight into Angela Merkel. Because they will be completely opposed on economic policy.
But hold on a second, because you're talking about the powers that be and the sort of control grid that's out of sight. And if it was so important that Hollande didn't win and Sarkozy won again another term, even though he's enormously unpopular, and he is making efforts to adopt some of the policies of Marine Le Pen. Yeah. Who's extreme right wing?
Belatedly, of course.
Belatedly, but he's got no choice because he wants her.
He wants her votes.
He wants her votes that he can't otherwise get. So how do you know that Hollande is going to win?
I don't know. I'm not, you know, but it certainly looks as if it's the case, because he's got a fantastic amount of support in France. Also, there's the fact that this Toulouse business a few weeks ago with this poor guy being killed has backfired on Sarkozy massively. Many French people think that this is a put-up job just to try and win him votes.
There's a website, sott.net, S-O-T-T.net, which is signofthetimes.net, which published this idea. Laura Knight Jadzik is one of the people who's involved there, and she's published that idea that it was a setup.
Well, actually, it's the
more
head,
or less as it was happening.
One of the heads of the French intelligence service has also said that this guy was working with French intelligence.
Well, also, the guy that they shot, the security services of France shot, was a thin, slight man, and the man who went to the synagogue or whatever it was, or the Jewish school, and shot those people there.
So it was a good shot.
Was a small, fat man in a leather leather outfit
could well have been
with
someone
a full face helmet
yeah.
and might not
this,
have been
this
the
looks
same.
Like some sort of stage-managed event in order to try and garner support for Sarkozy, because it did.
Well,
for
it
several
like
days,
this.
For several days, Sarkozy's poll ratings surged. But now the investigative journalism has been done into this, and the internet and the TV in France and the papers have been looking at it, so Sarkozy's support has plummeted.
So they were sold a pop, in other words.
Well, I mean, you know, it's just, I just feel sorry for the victims of these things. I mean, and we know many events that we're told about, the 7/7, 9/11, there are big, big questions about who was really behind these events. And I think one of the things I try and do is whenever there's a big terror event, so-called like that, that's spun by the mainstream press, I think it's important that we all try and pick these things apart as soon as possible.
And look at the perhaps not so mainstream press, because quite often there are little stories that quickly disappear that suggest something...
And also,
somewhat radically different.
Also,
has happened.
What happens often is little bits and pieces trickle out over a matter of weeks, whereas that will actually contradict the initial analysis by our mainstream media of these kind of events. And so another one, of course,
Are you saying there's an established story that they all pick up and run with?
Well, they what happens is the press simply tells everybody what the police are telling them.
Well, as we said before, it's called journalism, isn't it? Mm. Where the briefings, if you like, or the press releases that they get are simply recycled and made their own.
Well, the French police and in British cases, the British police, that what they say to the press is taken as gospel at the initial stages. And often, you know, it's data proved to be complete nonsense, as we found, for example, in 7/7. The 7/7 attacks, where the police and intelligence services told all the press, oh, these four alleged bombers are clean skins. We found out later that they've been following them for years.
I think one of the things about the European Union is I think people ran with it, because I've been campaigning against it soon after the Maastricht Treaty. If I go back
to... Well, do you want to show us that DVD?
Well, just a second.
CD?
Yeah, I will do. But
well, give it to me.
I go back to 1963.
This is a CD, isn't it? Of
this is the...
Oh, we've got a picture of it, actually. 104. If we can show 104.
Yeah.
This is a CD that you've put out that's got lots of documents.
It's the records from 1970, 71, 72 from the Foreign Office. It documents all the activities they got up to persuade Parliament and the people that it was a good thing. And for instance, they used the Foreign Office had a department called IRD, Sinister Sounding Information Research Department. Now, what they got up to is they had teams of people writing letters to the press, pro-EU letters. Now, obviously, civil servants can't sign their name and put it in the press. This is Joe Bloggs, works for Department X, and this is what I think.
So what they did... So they were seeding the newspapers with stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And who signed the letters? Well, members of the European movement. Their job was... They had hundreds of people who put their names to it. And there was lots of activities like this, which were extremely underhand. And, of course, people reading all these letters... Got the impression that we had to go into this.
So it was really popular.
And of course, Parliament picked this up, seeing the people were running with it. What you've got to remember is at the beginning of the campaign, only 20% of the people of this country wanted to join the common market. After this campaign, six-month campaign, leading up to the vote on the first...
referendum.
No, the Parliament that goes through three stages. You've got the first reading, and the second reading, the third reading. And it was vital for them to get the first reading through. And by the time, just before that time, they'd managed to move the public opinion to a 50%, a 50-50 position, which was enough to persuade parliamentarians to go and vote for it. A friend of mine who used to run a sub-post office, he used to say that when there's a promotion on TV for, say, some confectionery like Mars bars or something like that, he found his sales went up fourfold. So what it means is advertising works. Massive advertising works massively. And this is what happened in that bit. And what is funny is three months after the vote, the number of people wanted to go into join the common market dropped right back down to 20 or 30% again. So it was an artificial
situation. Well, they made the people of Ireland vote twice to join the euro, didn't they?
I think most people think that the EU stinks for whatever reason. I think, you know, we've had various examples. We've also now got the situation where we're being told that we have to fly the EU flag. I mean, this is the final obvious.
Well, it's on our number plates, isn't it?
On our government buildings, that the EU flag must be fly over the top of it. This kind of thing makes us realise, well, who's really pulling the strings? And of course, now we're in a situation of a difficult financial situation. We're relying more and more and more on the EU because of the massive funding that can come in if you toe the line with the EU. Also, our number of journalists employed is shrinking, and so there's less criticism of it. This all adds up, as far as I can see. I mean, I'm very pro-European generally, but we need a different type of Europe to this fascistic type of system that we've got now.
Well, you know, I mean, we haven't really covered the Eurozone and what's happened in countries like, the pigs, you know, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, Spain.
Maybe France.
And yes, well, France is weak, isn't it? I mean,
unless Holland gets elected, he'll probably fix it up.
Well, Hollande, yeah.
Hollande, yes.
But okay, let's look at the effect on those countries, and let's look what's happening. I think Greece is a perfect example of a country that has been squeezed beyond belief.
Well, there's the sort of thing they're doing in Greece now is. If people don't have, you know, people are really short of money, they're short of jobs, they can't make their way. If they can't pay their council tax, I don't know what they call it over in Greece, but.
Well, many people don't pay it anyway.
Been forced to, because what they've done now, they've tied it into the electricity bill. So if you don't pay your council tax, your electricity gets cut out. Now, this is a sort of fascio communistic type of way of running a country. I mean, the European Union was there, we're told, to make a life better for everybody. But what's it doing? It's doing just the opposite. I mean, what is more, they don't seem to care. When you see these people chuntering on television, they don't seem to have a concern of the world for the ordinary person. They just talk in generalities, and it's good for you to belong to, you know, it stops wars and all that sort of thing. Although my friend Nikolai Tolstoy will say, well, what wars has the European Union actually stopped? And then you have to think, well, which wars have they stopped? You know, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq and all those, which wars has it actually stopped? So what advantages are there in the European Union for the ordinary common man?
Well, the advantages we were told were things like a free market. You know, the common market was the big draw, wasn't it? But even now, if you go to France and buy a truckload of wine for your own use, for instance, I mean, I've never done this, but I know people have come back with lots of particular thing like cigarettes or something, and they've had their car seized, even if it's for their own use, you know.
Well, it's all about a centralisation of power. That's the way I see it, and particularly around financial power. So as, you know, over the centuries, as we've become more and more dependent on money, you know, so in the old days, people used to sort of grow their own food, they had a bit of land, this kind of thing. We're now absolutely locked into this industrial economy, but apart from in countries like Germany, our industrial economy in this country, for example, is crumbling. We're utterly dependent on money to live day to day, to feed our kids, to, you know, do everything, the basic stuff that we need to do. We're totally dependent on money, and it seems to me that the private interests that control that money system are trying to take over political power. Isn't that what you...
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's all about... We've demonstrated tonight, and I think everybody knows it, that the European Union is a symptom of the disease of big global businesses using that as a tool to run the world in the way in which they want. But there's nothing in it for the ordinary person anymore.
The politicians are not acting in our interests. I mean, I think that's what you're trying to say, isn't it?
Well, they've been bought off, haven't they? I mean, you know, the politicians who kowtow to the real powers behind the scenes, we're talking about the people. This is one of the things about the Bilderbergers that we don't necessarily... When I first went to a meeting, I was shocked because some of these most powerful people in the world I've never ever seen on television, don't hardly recognise their name. But this is the guy who's the chairman of the European Central Bank. This is the guy who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve. These are some of the most rich and powerful people in the world, and yet you wouldn't recognise them if you walked down the street. And it comes...
Well,
this comes back to the media, doesn't it? And the mainstream media should be pointing these things out, interrogating these people, it'd be like Roger Cook. Do you remember him in the old days?
I do, indeed.
If someone wasn't going to come on TV, if you phoned them up and they wouldn't come on, he would go out and start to doorstep them. You know, by the way, he had a viewing figures of 13 million back in the 1990s when his programme was pulled from him. So there was political motives behind getting rid of Roger Cook from the TV, for example. Yeah. You know, we've got a situation now where, for example, the BBC's flagship politics programme, Newsnight, right? Their political editor, Michael Crick, has quit recently. You know why he quit?
Because
he's been there for years. But he quit because what was happening was the BBC was deleting massive... You know, he'd go out and do an interview and the BBC would keep the bit, or the editors would keep the bit that they wanted of that interview and trash the rest. He said, well, hang on a minute, what about history? What about posterity? And he's been replaced by this woman.
Oh, well, they would actually not store it,
no.
You mean?
They wouldn't actually
even though it's never been cheaper.
It's never ever been shown.
It's never been cheaper to store it because it's electronic. You can store it. Yeah.
No problem, right?
Cyberspace.
I mean, you might have noticed quite a lot of what the BBC do is wiped out after a week. It's disappeared forever.
Right,
then you can't get to it again,
that's right.
Which would be very, very easy for them to keep going.
Also got
the most important thing about this is Allegra Stratton, for example, right? She's taken over from Michael Crick on Newsnight. She signed a book deal with Hodder and Stroughton to write a book about Miliband and what a successful Prime Minister he would make. How can she be the editor of Newsnight?
David or Ed?
Ed. How can she be the editor of Newsnight when she's signed a deal and she's quite clearly, you know, nailed her colours to the post as a Milibandite? She's the political editor of Newsnight.
I'd like to interject there.
Dave, yes.
We talked a lot about the Bilderbergers, though they're the bête noire of the whole thing, but you've got to also remember a lot of other international events, particularly Davos, which is a meeting that takes place in Davos once a year.
Mm-hmm.
This is Switzerland, yeah. And that's basically a meeting between the bankers and the politicians. And I suspect that the politicians are getting their instructions and orders from the bankers at that meeting.
Well, that's much more open, Davos, to the press.
Yeah,
David
Cameron came back from Davos last year. And what did he say? He said, we must stop knocking the bankers. Now, why did he, you know, he should have waited about 6 months before he said that. But he said it as soon as he got back. So what was he taught to say? There's the world. There's other.
He who pays the piper calls the tune nowadays. Yeah. I'm afraid that's the way it is.
We're going to go for another break now. Our last one. Once again, please text in your questions or comments to Tony Gosling and Dave Barnby, and I will definitely read some out. See you very soon.
One Step Beyond. In association with Nexus Magazine. One Step Beyond. In association with Nexus Magazine.
Welcome back to One Step Beyond with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guest, Tony Gosling and Dave Barnby. Okay, just before the break then, we were talking about the bankers and the way that they appear to control who's in power and what happens. And we looked at the French presidential elections and Sarkozy and whether he will or won't be re-elected, despite being hugely unpopular.
What we've seen with Mario Monti is the emergence of the banker types actually out into the public.
Actually no longer, being in charge, yeah, an no unelected
longer,
leader.
No longer behind the scenes. They're now actually out there running the countries. And you know, this is incredible, isn't it? Goldman Sachs and the IMF appointing our prime ministers for us and telling us whether we're allowed to have a general election. This is incredible. This is one of the things that worries me in Britain. I don't know about everybody else, but one of the first things that Cameron said when he got in was, oh, we need fixed-term parliaments.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
Isn't
absolutely
that funny?
Disgusting.
Because he's teetering on the brink. Of course he wants a fixed-term parliament so that it's impossible for the Liberal Democrats to pull the...
Well, he'll be a lame duck for 3 years if he does that, won't he?
Well, the thing is, if the Liberal Democrats pulled the rug out from under the Conservatives, then, you know, the fact is it could become a Labour-Lib Dem coalition, couldn't it? And Ed Miliband.
It's fair to say that Charles
could
Kennedy,
become.
If Charles Kennedy was still in charge of the Liberal Democrat Party, I think he would have done it long ago. But Nick Clegg is a yes man. He does what he's told. And he's not going to do that.
I don't think.
Who tells him, do you think?
Well, who knows? But he's certainly, he's not the sort of guy to rock the boat. He wants everyone to be happy and smiling, and, you know, he doesn't want to do that kind of thing.
I mean, looking at Italian politics, which you just mentioned there, Monty, because, you know, Berlusconi seemed like the worst possible leader of any country ever, didn't he?
Apart from the fact... He was popular, though, wasn't he?
Well... He ran a television channel, so...
But there's a political game going on here. Come on, in Nazi Germany, they were in a terrible, terrible financial situation, and it was perfect for the emergence of someone like Hitler on the scene. He could arrive, he could sort things. Look, I'm the guy who'll sort things out. And most Germans welcomed Hitler.
Well,
he was democratically elected.
Well, Germany had lost the First World War and was in a terrible state.
If you create something terrible like Berlusconi or the financial situation in Germany in the 1930s, you're creating a red carpet for the next Hitler.
There was a lot of opposition to Hitler back in the 30s.
But he won a democratic election.
Yes, he did. There was a lot of opposition.
Well, he had a bit of help by burning the Reichstag.
He had a lot of help from the financial situation at the time.
But he had a lot of opposition, but they all got bumped off.
Everybody was throwing their hands up saying, what are we going to do? And this is what bothers me about our present crisis, is potentially there could be a dodgy character come along in the future who will say, I'll sort things out for you, you know.
I think you are wrong to create the impression that there wasn't opposition to Hitler. There was a lot of massive opposition,
elected,
but he eliminated it. I said you gave the impression.
No, I didn't. I said he was democratically elected.
You said there were a lot of people.
Okay, well, we don't need to argue about that, do we? But we're looking at how the public is manipulated by things that happen. And you talked about that thing that happened in Toulouse that may or may not have been state-sanctioned, Sarkozy-sanctioned, in order to have him re-elected. But something very, very big and newsworthy happened not so long ago in Norway. Anders Breivik and the slaughter, well, in the capital and in Utøya, that island. And I know you've got some ideas about that, haven't you, Tony?
I mean, certainly some of the... probably the weirdest thing about all this is that Norwegian prosecutors have said, he was a lone gunman, he wasn't working with anybody. Well, we know that in 2002, Anders Breivik was over in Britain.
That is 10 years ago, though, isn't it?
Yeah, setting up a far-right terror network, really. I mean, I think it's fair to call it that, with the English Defence League. With some of the founder members of the English Defence League. He was in Britain in 2000.
And this is in the public domain, isn't
it?
This
the Norwegian police have been over to interview these EDL people, or ex-EDL people, some of them. And so Scotland Yard interviewed them. So how can the Norwegian police say he wasn't working with anybody? He's also got internet access, by the way, in jail, I'm told, by the Norwegians.
So he's allowed to send emails to people?
God knows what
Forget
he's
saying. Forget we had a meeting.
Which is really, really worrying, you know.
They're like that, the Norwegians, though, aren't they? They're a bit
very
sort
liberal,
of like...
But
in his manifesto, which he posted up, first of all, you know, a lot of the things, important things about the Breivik massacre, the press seem to be trying to get us to forget about. One is that he was a Freemason. There is all his Masonic regalia. He proudly put on his Facebook site.
Yes.
The other thing is, I mean, well, there are loads of things. But another thing is his love of Zionism. He was saying that basically, the Utøya Island where he attacked, there was a camp there. Part of it was a...
It was the Labour Party, wasn't it? Labour Youth.
Sort of great grassroots socialist type. You know,
it was a youth camp for future leaders,
and they had a whole thing going on there about boycotting Israel. In fact, one of the spokespeople from there had been in a newspaper 2 days before the massacre, a national newspaper in Norway, saying, you know, it's time to boycott Israel. We need to send a clear message to the Israeli government that they mustn't send tanks in to kill Palestinians, this kind of thing, and that's a good way to do it. So, you know. Nobody seems to have reminded us that actually Breivik was a vehement Zionist. He had a very strange form of Christianity, didn't he? Don't you think? A bit like Tony Blair's form of Christianity.
Well, Tony Blair's an interesting case, isn't he? Because Tony Blair converted to Catholicism just in time that he might become president of Europe.
That's handy, isn't it?
That was handy. Yeah. And of course, we all know he's a confirmed Christian because he ordered the bombing of Bosnian children on Christmas Day, and that's a way of celebrating, the birth of Christ.
Well, there is some evidence he's actually a Rosicrucian, Blair. But anyway, you know, I don't want to hear about anybody going to the European Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, like they were calling for Gaddafi, until Blair and Bush and these people have been arrested and put on trial. Let's see what evidence there is against these people. And they're walking the streets. This bothers me. We've got a culture of impunity now, where people have been involved in what, you know, many people would say are massive war crimes, who are just walking the streets as if nothing had happened.
So, Anders Breivik, let's get back to Anders Breivik. OK, he had some nasty connections. He is a Freemason. Is he working for some major political agenda, do you think?
Well, it's possible that this was someone had ordered him to do this as a hit. I mean, quite who that might be. What could the purpose be, though?
That's what I'm interested in.
Basically, to destroy the up-and-coming socialist movement and the political movement in Norway. To look at, not looking at the existing socialist movement and socialist parties in Norway, the Labour parties, they're looking at the very young people who may come up through the years and in 20, 30 years' time take office in Norway. This is a very sophisticated and particularly hideous hit, as far as I can see.
It's not the really best way of going about things if you want to change the country from a left wing to a right wing.
It's taking a very long term view and quite cynical, nasty long term view. Mm. And also,
it allows for a more of a police state to come into being if everyone feels threatened.
Well,
And it's like the Hegelian dialect, isn't it? It's problem, reaction, solution. Mm-hmm.
But it's opened up a whole new thing about terrorism. We've been taught by the mainstream press over the last 10 years since 9/11 that the big danger is Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda terrorists, these nasty bearded ones.
Well, the bad Al-Qaeda, the good Al-Qaeda, of course, are working with the CIA in Syria, Libya and places like that.
Libya's turned into an absolute.
This is the way in which governments control people by keeping them worried, keeping them scared about terrorism or their jobs or whatnot. Then you look for strong government, don't you? And you're likely to do
something like 20,000 political prisoners now in Al Qaeda's Libya. You know, this is complete and utter hypocrisy, and it's the battles of convenience. So that's the way I see it. But Breivik has opened up this whole new area of this sort of far right Christian Zionist style terror, and I think we're going to be seeing more of that sort of thing possibly in the future. Let's also look back at the Operation Gladio.
Gladio were the left behind NATO.
Well, they were using fascists very much like Breivik to create
stir up the Cold War, wasn't it? To make it not go away,
and then to blame it on somebody
military
else.
Military-industrial complex.
Absolutely. And the state railway station bombing in Bologna, for instance, that was is now acknowledged as being.
There was a whole program,
Operation Gladio,
over something like this is all organised from NATO intelligence.
Yeah.
And one other thing you could bring in here to go back to the Nazi connection is that Paul Hauser, who was a Panzer Corps commander in Hitler's SS, he actually said the first meetings of NATO were from the members of the international supporters of the SS. This is the very first meetings, and this is Paul Hauser, if you want to check it out, the quote, actually said that after the war, that the first meetings in NATO were SS's international supporters.
Okay, I'm going to read some text because I feel that I've...
Neglected your...
Yeah. Nikki has asked, what can we do to help ourselves?
Well, ultimately, I think, you know, we've all got to believe in some kind of proper democratic system and look at actually fixing the system the way it is. I think there's a lot of people out there who are trying to do that, and we need to just back them up. There's, for example, party funding is one of the biggest problems. Our political parties are totally controlled at the top. However much you want to join a party, you can't actually change anything because they're not democratic. So let's take away the funding from those parties, the big business funding. One of the things that has been looked at is this thing called the rolling referendum. We need some fresh new ideas, don't we? You know,
we need politicians who are acting in our behalf rather than working for somebody else.
And if they say something stupid, do something we don't like a war we don't agree with, we can literally go online and take away our little bit of the party funding from them.
Well, 1 million people marched against the war in Iraq, and yet we invaded Iraq. At least 1 million people.
Correct.
What I'd like to see is I'd like to see a disincentive for politicians to do the wrong thing. So as soon as they start a war which people don't agree with, suddenly their party funding goes down. This is something called called the rolling referendum, which has been put forward by several people. It's been looked at by some of the fringe parties in Britain already, where you can go online or send a letter in the post if you don't like one particular, and you can switch your little bit of funding. Every individual voter would have their own little bit of funding in between elections. You can say, right, I didn't like what I saw on the TV last night about my party. I'm going to switch it to a different one this week.
But, in principle it sounds like it might have some mileage, but the fact is that there's endless amounts of funding from bankers, isn't there, if they really want to do it that way.
But if you have only the voters being able to fund parties, the bankers won't get a look in, right? They're not allowed to fund the parties anymore. And that would stop this terrible situation.
But they're the ones. The politicians are the ones. This asking the politicians to vote for this is like turkeys to vote for Christmas.
No, it isn't necessarily, because a lot of the political parties have got real problem raising funds. The Liberal Democrats, for example, are having trouble. The Labour Party are having trouble. Even the Conservative Party quite often have trouble going around with the begging bowl, to get money.
So, well, do you have any solutions, Dave?
Well, you told me not to talk about it, but every country should be run by a constitution.
Well, I agree.
And the trouble is, in this country, we have two constitutions. We have the one which Parliament makes up as it goes along. If you read books by Bagehot and Bogdanov, you'll see that the government likes to invent its own constitution.
Let me show you this is what you...
Whereas we actually have a real constitution.
The reason I didn't say don't talk about this, and I said there's no point in mentioning this necessarily, because I mentioned this when I interviewed Albert Burgess.
Yeah, right,
Burgess produced this book, but I'm very happy to show the camera again. This is Layman's Guide to the English Constitution by Albert Burgess, who was on this show just a few weeks ago.
And published by me.
And published by you, I understand that, yes. And it is a very good book, and it is a good guide to our constitution, but that was something I tackled on another programme. Yeah.
And our media and our democracy can sometimes work. Would you like to be David Cameron today?
Would I like to be David Cameron?
Would you like to be Jeremy Hunt today?
No, I certainly wouldn't.
It's like the Indians are circling around the caravan right now, aren't they? You know, there's a lot of pressure on the current government.
Yeah, but the question is how we should provide some solutions to the problem we're in. And this is not a new problem. This has happened since time immemorial. We had the first Reform Act in 1832, where people got to vote, if you remember.
But some people got the vote.
Can I finish, please?
Just get on, yeah.
And then there were subsequent Reform Acts, and people started getting the vote, and we seem to be going somewhere. But it's all been given away because they circumvented the democratic process by Bilderberg and European Union and such like that. Whereas if we enforced the constitution we have, they wouldn't have been able to do some of the things.
I think we've got to get away from apathy. Get involved. Get engaged. Do whatever it means. Even getting...
Tell everybody what's going on.
Get inside a political party and act from within, but don't get apathetic. That's what they want you to do. That's what the Bilderbergers want everyone to do. The financiers want everyone to be apathetic. Get engaged. Get involved.
On that note, that's all we've got time for. Thank you to everyone for joining in, for those who texted, and thanks to my special guests, Tony Gosling and Dave Barmby. For more information on Tony Gosling's radio show, visit thisweek.org.uk. I look forward to inviting you to take One Step Beyond again. Until then, may the God you seek be you.
Thanks.
Good night.
Thank you.
Beyond, in association with Nexus Magazine.